Oi, you. It's time for another episode of Dorothy and the Dealer. Let's tune into the conversation.
Okay, Dorothy and Dealer kicking off. Good morning, Amelia. How are you?
I'm good. How are you, Mitchell?
I'm really good. And we have one of our cool guests back here with us today because... based on popular demand.
Everyone loves Dr. Dave.
They do.
Look at him. He gets all shy. He looks all shy when he's like...
I know who he really is.
Really?
No. But that's what I was thinking this morning. Let's find out a little bit about, you know, what's your story, Dave? How did you go from, you know, training to be a GP, medical practitioner, mm-hmm. you're right, to getting into looking at it from another perspective, from a holistic side of things, and how did it all come about?
And mm-hmm. welcome back as well.
And well, it's lovely.
Thanks so much. I feel a bit like part of the furniture.
Okay. We probably need to move him on. No, I'm joking. But how did it all come about?
Yeah, tell us your story.
Great to have you here. It is great to have you here.
Yeah, great to be here. So it's a sort of long story, but maybe mm-hmm. I can backtrack a little mm-hmm. bit and move forward and see if it comes together in some mm-hmm. kind of mm-hmm. coherent. So maybe if I go back to like high school and I wasn't that kid that wanted to be a doctor. I didn't come from a family of doctors. Was just a bit of a rat bag at school. And
were you smart?
Not stupid, but not, you know, not a genius, definitely not. And used to get sent out of class a lot and was fairly distracted, bit of a larrikin.
Yeah.
And took a lot of punishment from the teachers.
And then
probably through like towards the end of secondary school, I sort of woke up and was like, gosh, I had the idea. I thought, you know, it'd be great to do medicine. It was highly competitive.
Right.
And, seemed like a good career. I'd loved human biology and, you know, talking and the sort of social aspects of communicating with people. And I didn't do well in my tertiary exams, okay?
Right.
Because I didn't commit to it. I just thought I'll get into it, you know? So there's a story that not that many people know about me, which is I studied year 11 and 12, and then in year 12 I got a score and I looked at it and I was like, I can't do medicine with this.
Right.
And then I actually went back and repeated year 12.
Did you?
People don't know this. And I took a few different subjects.
Yeah.
I'd sort of passed English and maths and stuff the first time, but I'd graduated. And then, I went back and I actually had to do some bridging because there were subjects I took on in year 12 the second time, which I hadn't done in year 11.
Mm-hmm.
So in the school holidays I would...
And did you need those subjects?
Yeah.
You needed them to get into to study.
Right.
Right. And into medical school. And you got to get some pretty high marks.
You do. You have to work. There are people that are sort of naturally gifted.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't say that that was me. I was sort of a worker.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But yeah, it's a competitive industry to go into.
You got to slog it out a bit.
You do.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a time where I was doing the year 11 work in the holidays, sending to this one. I had a lot of good guidance from teachers and would send the assignments in the mail with a $1 coin in the envelope to my teacher, and he would mark them, send it back to me with the $1, using the $1 for the postage stamp.
Right.
Just to get me up to speed with the
the
work. Yeah.
You weren't trying to bribe him with the dollar.
Oh, yeah. That was part of it. Just 50 cents bribe, 25 cents the postage, and a little kicker
it's
on the
showing side. Your age now, Dave. 25 cent postage. No.
Definitely. I finally got into medicine and went off to uni and started learning all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a big world.
Mm-hmm.
It's competitive. There's a lot of smart kids. There's a lot of competition.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of ego. There's a lot of
There is. Right.
You know, I suppose you're told from a very early stage that you're clever.
Mm-hmm.
So kids are clever.
Right.
And they've worked hard and they really get that mindset. And they're like, you're clever. You're in the top percentage. You're going to be a doctor, you know, you are
right.
up here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's a real feeling of that.
Right.
Right.
Fast forward a little bit, so went through, you know, 6 years of training, took some time to travel along the way, which is very me, and popped out the other side as a, you know, young doctor, an intern.
Right.
That's what you're mm-hmm. sort of labelled here in Australia. And then you sort of start within the public hospital system, so mm-hmm. you generally mm-hmm. start in a big tertiary hospital. For me, it was... Sir Charles Gardner and Joondalup and various other local hospitals. And then you start to learn the art of medicine. You've read some books. Often you think you're really pretty elite. You've read some textbooks. You've had you passed exams. You've got people telling you that you're, you know, in this elite category. And then you step out and you realize you know nothing.
Right. When was that point?
When you're
for
in
you?
The world.
When you realize you knew nothing.
Yeah, when I really stepped down into the hospital system.
Right. Yeah. So what made you think that? What made you?
It's just big. You're at the bottom of the food chain. It's a real hierarchical pecking order. Mm-hmm.
Right.
You've got, you know, consultant specialists, you've got registrars, you've got residents down to the intern.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have a hierarchy within the nursing system. You've got clinical nurse specialists and managers and, you know, who have been doing jobs for 30 years. And then you've got this new license and you're running around the hospital, you know, trying to help people and to take some orders and some guidance from people that know a lot more.
Wow.
For me, I probably jarred with the system early on some level. Like, even through medical school, there was always a part of me that didn't feel quite satiated by it. Some of the ideas conflicted with me.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then sort of, not that I was aware of it at the time, but I was carrying my own life's baggage. All the, you know, the programming from my childhood and the upbringing and the rigidities that I'd stored in my own mind. And then the system can be quite brutal, the public health system, as far as it's probably much better than it is in other countries.
Right.
And I know, Mitch, you're from Ireland, and things there can be pretty dire.
Yeah.
You are learning to run before you can walk in a system where it's complex. You're looking after people with complex problems. You often feel out of your depth. You're having to learn a lot on the job.
Yeah.
Looking after people with complex problems. Often your seniors and your superiors are elsewhere or, you know, incapacitated, doing other things, and you don't have that level of support that you feel you need.
So is it easy to make a mistake?
It is.
Right.
Definitely.
Because you've nobody to support you and you think, well, what the fuck do I do here? I have to do something, and you just act and do something.
You do have people to support you, but they're not always at hand.
Right.
And there's good and bad to that as well.
Right.
It teaches you to learn to be self-sufficient and to get the information, but there's times where you could potentially do something with somebody's healthcare that makes a big, you know, an extraordinary implications without knowing that you're making a mistake.
And is that intense to be in that environment, knowing that you could do something and fuck something up? And
I can only speak for me, and yeah, it is. I felt oppressed. I felt like there was a lot on my shoulders, and it was just a matter of time, or, you know, there's a lot of expectation.
Right.
From myself as well. But
because you've got a conscience, because...
Right.
Yeah. Does your conscience play a big role in that?
Definitely.
Right.
Definitely.
Yeah, because you feel like, fuck, I could get something wrong here and harm someone.
I can think of one particular case where I was doing a surgical job. I was as the intern on the surgical team, and obviously the boss is in the consultant in the operating theatre doing the procedures. The registrar, who's the sort of next step down, is in assisting. And then the residents who are above the intern are doing other things, other aspects of patient care. And I'd found a blood test for a little old lady that was on the surgical team, but most of our ward care was on one particular ward, one floor. And then this lady was what we call an outlier. So she was on another ward, but she was a surgical patient being looked after by us. And late in the day, I discovered a blood test that showed that her kidneys were... She was in kidney failure, little old lady. And I forget what the primary problem was that she was being looked after from a surgical point of view, but I rushed down to, you know, start to have a look at a medication chart and to see why her kidneys were off. And I had one of the medical registrars was there, and he's sort of like two or three steps up the chain as far as seniority. And he went mental at me. He'd seen the blood tests and he's like, you're killing... He said in front of the patient, you're killing this little old woman. You personally, you're killing this woman.
Holy.
And, you know, I was on the brink of tears and was like, you know, this is inappropriate to be speaking in front of the patient like this. But, you know, you carry that stuff with you and you're learning and you're kind of like, it's a sort of baptism of fire in some ways.
So hold on, let me get this right. So you had found this chart and you'd run down to see, and he was blaming you on not seeing it earlier, picking it up earlier. Was that what it was?
Right, me and the surgical team. There's a real banter between medical and surgical in hospitals, which people don't may not be aware of. The surgeons are the cutters and are sort of often perceive that their aftercare is not that good, and then the medical team are the thinkers who don't do the surgical procedures, but they oversee the complex care. So he was basically saying, you and your surgical team, you're neglecting this woman, you're not caring for her adequately.
Oh, right.
And you know, you've stuffed her kidneys by doing this, and you've...
Asshole.
Right.
So, you know, I spoke to him later a while down the track, and we smoothed it out.
right.
But it was very intimidating at the time. Yeah,
would be.
Yeah. Oh, of course.
So how long were you in the system before you kind of decided, you realised that, I don't know. That
what happened? What was the defining moment where you, okay, just
Sure. I think so giving that some context, I was carrying this imposter syndrome, and some listeners will be familiar with that idea that you don't feel enough, or you're waiting to get that tap on the shoulder to say, are you qualified? Are you a doctor? You're not trained for this. And I think I'd probably battled that for a large part of my education and my early career, because there's such a vast amount of knowledge to know.
Mm-hmm.
And you sort of constantly feel like you're buried within it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that plays into the idea that, you know, you're not enough or you're inadequate. So I had that imposter syndrome was definitely a factor for me. And then things had just been building. I just signed a new contract. I was doing a renal job, looking after kidneys and dialysis. And
in the hospital system.
Within the hospital system. Mm-hmm. And I more or less was asked to do a role that I felt sort of insufficiently trained to do.
Mm-hmm.
I was asked to hold the sort of phone that covers the state of WA, looking after kidneys and nephrology,
mm-hmm.
sort of takes all the calls from around the state, people with problems, and it's part of the training, but I really felt at that time it was beyond me. Mm-hmm. And I sort of, for about 3 days, I knew this, I had to do this night shift, and night shift is common, done a lot of night shift, as you'd imagine.
Uh-huh.
But to hold this phone really, you know, brought me to palpitations, and I went back and forth home to hospital for 3 nights in a row. I didn't sleep. I was just like, you know, I'm terrified. This is, you know. And then I just got to a point where it brought up so much. It just killed my mojo.
Yeah.
I just had to leave. I was at work one day. I just signed a new contract, as I said, for a year, and was literally pacing around the dialysis unit, agitated, highly agitated, and I ran into a friend and he's like, are you okay? And I just broke down and said, no, I'm not okay at all, I'm quitting this job. He's like, what? I help you? Can I support you?
Uh-huh.
So I went from the dialysis unit straight to there's a body that look after doctors. It's postgraduate medical education. Once you've graduated, they sort of oversee your care. So I went down and I said, I'm resigning, and they said, you can't. And I said, well, I just wrote mental health on a bit of paper and just handed it to him and walked out.
Right.
And that
shit
really for me was like the start of something. I thought it was the worst time of my life. I was like, a lot of my identity was revolving around the idea of being a doctor, you know, that, you know, whatever status that comes with it or respect, and that is prominent for a lot of people. That's part of the ego and the arrogance that plays into it, and the sort of feeling that you know it all type mentality that I was sort of drawing on before. But it just was very confronting.
Yeah.
So how did you heal?
How did I heal? So it was one step at a time, really. I took a long hiatus from medicine, like close to 2 years. I said I'd never go back. I said, I'm done with this. This system is... I was probably quite blaming of the system. Mm-hmm. I was like, this is a rigid system. You know, you can't get your leave. You're not supported to take your holidays. You can't get your personal development time.
Mm.
There's no real advocacy for junior doctors. But then I had to start to look at myself, which, you know, is great because it plays into what I've talked about on previous podcasts with you guys around responsibility and not looking at the external world so much as looking at as a reflection of what's happening internally.
Yep.
So it started a journey into self and self-care.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So I just started to pull on a string like a ball of wool and just let it unravel and see what it was actually about.
What was it actually about?
Well, a few things. a big thing that came up was a lack of awareness. I'd been on sort of autopilot for years from an emotional point of view.
Yeah.
I was very much can do sort of a guy, get it done at any cost, and not that aware of how it's feeling. You know, bury the emotions, squash it down, hide from it. You know, if I was, say I had to work and immediately before the shift there was something quite pivotal or something big happening in my life, I would just drop it and I would be straight, you know, I couldn't miss a shift, couldn't
really
ring up and take time off. I'd be like, look, this has got to stop. I suppose what I'm saying is the rest of my life fitted in around work.
Yeah.
And it was everything else was preparation to get me to that
next shift.
That
next
shift. Thing, and that was the thing that mattered.
Yeah.
So it was 99%, you know, sort of, don't get me wrong, I still did things that I enjoyed, but a vast part of my life was just dedicated to being at work and looking after others.
Yeah.
But I didn't have any awareness to reflect back at myself and say, I'm not coping.
Right, you
know?
Right. Yeah.
I'm not, I don't do these things. Yeah. I don't know how to live well.
Yeah.
Right.
So I suppose it was born out of a need to change.
Yeah.
I had the crisis that said, you know, you're not happy. I wasn't. I was really sort of deeply unhappy. Things were good in my life. I didn't have that many, you know, traumatic events or, you know, family deaths or big crises going on, but internally I felt there was a lot more within me to give, but I wasn't getting it out, and I was bottled up and unhappy.
How did you deal with that? What happened? What did you do?
Immediately they have some sort of advocacy for junior doctors, so once you sort of cite mental health as a reason, you kind of get funneled into this doctor's advisory service where and I went to see a really good GP. He was a family, he still works, really great doctor, sort of in his 70s, I would say.
Right.
Family practice doctor. And I spoke to him and he he's a great doctor. He has a filing cabinet next to his where he works, and he pulls out poems and he pulls out quotes from great people. He pulled out a quote from Rumi.
Did he?
And it was Rumi's is it called Rooms? Maybe, or it's the one about inviting people into your house, and he's talking about emotions.
Right.
It's a sort of metaphor. And he just said, look, you need to follow your heart. You know, you've invested a lot of time and money and effort and so many things into this education.
Yeah.
But look where you are, so slow down, take some time and figure out what's important to you. You know, and that's what I did.
That's a great piece of advice.
It is.
Have you studied any Rumi stuff?
Not a great deal. Things pop up from time to time, but I think the work's amazing.
Sufism is insane. It's really cool. Really cool.
Yeah. So then.
So tell us about what. Okay.
Like the breakthrough.
The nuts and bolts. What was the breakthrough? What was the.
Sure. So at the same time, I actually left an amazing relationship as well.
Right.
So I'd been with a woman for like 5 years and it was really good.
Yeah.
But I wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was unhappy and not with her, but just deeply. And I thought that the best way to get away and to understand myself was to make a split. So I left and I fell into meditation. I fell into Vipassana meditation, which some listeners might be familiar with. And I went to a convent setting for 10 days and sat in silence and just learned to meditate 14 hours a day and came
full
back.
Full on.
Yeah.
People don't realize how full on the Vipassanas actually are until they turn up there and they realize within an hour that they got to sit there for 6 hours meditating.
Right. So you obviously have some experience there.
Yeah, I've had a couple of, I've never done one, but I've had lots and lots and lots of my clients come through and do them many times. I have a funny story of one of our old clients, Dean Powell. He went and did one and he said on day three, he couldn't communicate with anybody. So he'd go into this room. So he got a banana. And he started writing on the banana messages and handing it over to some of the people in the room.
So, I mean, he would have been contravening the rules there. No pens, no papers.
No pens, no paper. But you can
bananas are okay.
Banana, you can write on a banana with your fingernail. That's what he was doing.
So for those that don't know, that style of meditation, it's forces you to confront a lot of problems, or, you know, the rigidities in mind. You sit there and you're not speaking to anyone for 10 days, no phones, no nothing. There's guided sort of meditation to teach you how to do the process, but then you're there alone in your head in silence and it's all bubbling up. It's like a volcano erupting with emotions and things that you've suppressed, and it just comes up and it says, address me. So it's amazing. Like, that was a huge factor for me in the sort of beginning of starting to heal, and that became my sort of daily self-care practice, was to meditate.
So the funny thing was, when I was going through my whole thing, my thing was with my dad, you know, who's a great man. Like, he's just a great guy. But I just had this shit that was caught up inside of me that was just, it was just there. Even though I was an adult, I'd be like, that's just nonsense. But it wasn't. It was caught in the kid in me, you know, and the kid was running the show, you know. Wait, who was it for you? What was it for you?
Same. It's my father. And I went to a psychologist, traditional psychologist initially, and would sit there with my arms folded, and she would say, she probably clocked me as soon as I came in the room, and I was talking about career, and I'm just lost with medicine, and I'm unhappy, and I've got this imposter syndrome, and, you know, overanalyzing thing, and she would bring it back, and she'd be like, tell me about your parents, tell me about your father. I'd sit there with my arms folded, and be like, yeah, he's great. Great guy, which he is. He is great, but I didn't have the level of awareness at that stage to be able to say that and believe it. I had had a sort of a great childhood on one level, but also I had felt that he was, there was a lot of hostility and a lot of aggression, which wasn't really about me so much as it was about my father with his own battles. And, you know, I can see that now, and I can understand that and start to love him for who he is and realize what he actually did for me. I used to say, I'm making it in spite of him. That was my mentality, you know. I'm making it in spite of my father, but what I didn't realize, I'm making it because of my father, you know. And that was so profound. So I started to unpack that stuff, but traditional psychology was pretty limited for me. Maybe that was the way I came into it, but sort of going around in circles a little bit and not really getting that much rubber on the road. Ideas had started to percolate, but that was it. And then somewhere after that, I got in, I fell in with you guys. I'm trying to think what else happened. Lots of lonely walks on the beach and reflection. I just started to build a daily practice that allowed me to connect with myself. And I say again, I feel like I was on autopilot for close to 30 years where I was denying the emotional aspect of my being, which is really the main thing that matters in life. Doesn't matter what happens, it matters how you feel about it and how you react to it.
Yeah,
100%.
So let's talk a little bit about your daily practice and and if, you know, how we spoke off mic a little bit about your true concept, which I thought was actually excellent.
Well, I think that just with that, right, just before we go into that, right, I think that the importance of telling your story is because we spent the last, I think it was the previous podcast, talking a little bit about, like, the mind-body connection and understanding how one impacts the other. And that was happening for you. You know, you're not just talking about it because you just made it up last Thursday. Do you know what I mean? It's something that happened for you. You realized that you were going off and doing this, but you had to make a difference in your life. You had to make a change in your life. And sometimes the change comes about because something big happens and a big crisis happens on the outside, you know. And when that happens, you're forced to make a change, you know. But that isn't what needs to happen in order for people to make little shifts in their life to actually shift their behavior and shift how they go about life and shift how much stress they have in their lives and shift all of this stuff that, like, was happening for you, right? So let's talk a little bit about that, about those behavior changes and what people can actually do.
I was just going to say, I think people intuitively know on a deeper level that something's often not right. And I think for me, I'd known that for a long time, but I'd the thing for me, I was traveling and running around the world while in between studies trying to find it. Trying to get away from it or find what it was. But you just a little... Travel's amazing. At the moment it's difficult, but just a little side message for people. You don't need to go and sit in a cave in the Himalayas to come up with the answers. But you can get it sitting at home with your eyes shut and connecting with your heart. It doesn't matter where you are. You just need to be connecting with yourself. And that's ultimately the answers lie. As far as behavior change goes... it can come with a crisis. Absolutely, but hopefully it doesn't have to come to that. Often that's, you know, it's the cancer diagnosis or it's being told that you've got diabetes or you're sick or you're you know, at work having a panic attack.
Yeah.
That inspiration for change comes out of pain and suffering often.
Yep.
But it can be done without.
Yeah.
What you're referencing, Mitch, is true change, which stands for time. R is for resources / finances, but resources as an umbrella term. E is for energy, and W is for, I know that's not how you spell true. I'm a doctor.
Yeah. But, are you sure you're a doctor?
W being willingness.
Right.
Yeah. So in thinking about any behaviour change that somebody is going to make, firstly you need to decide how these are going to be obstacles for you, or how they're going to be, you know, gates to step through.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, I think that's a really important point first up. First thing you have to have, I think, awareness that the things that are happening aren't happening, they're not in the way. They're something that can be part of the way.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? And I think right. that just having that awareness, I think, makes a difference, right?
It's like everything that has happened has purpose.
Has a
purpose.
The
only reason you're frustrated is because is not because of what happened. It's because you haven't seen the purpose in it. Because when you see the purpose in it, you'll embrace it and not want to change it and realize, fuck, okay. You know, what used to drive my frustration. I don't get, you know, what's going on here. What is the purpose of this? Do you know, what am I meant to learn from this?
Right. And that's that framework that we talked about as far as looking at what's happening. For me, when I left the hospital system, it felt like it was the worst time of my life. Mm-hmm. I was giving up on my career. I'd left the woman that I loved, and I would just... It felt awful, uncomfortable. I didn't want to sit with it. I was like, this is the worst. How could anything be good about this?
Mm-hmm.
I realize now it was the biggest blessing that could have possibly happened. It had to happen that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. To bring me to who I am now.
Mm-hmm.
And there'll be another crisis around the corner for me that if I have the wisdom to look at it and say, oh, what's this? Oh, this is what this is.
Mm-hmm.
Not poor me. But this is another portal.
Yes. Yeah. It's another door. Which is what we were talking about yesterday. You know?
Yeah.
Anyway, cool.
Yeah, true change. People have to understand that if you want to make change, you're going to have to change.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, that sounds ridiculous.
Oh, so many people don't get that, though. They think they can be the same person and change is just going to happen to them.
I'm not the same person that I was 5 years ago. Almost unrecognizable on the interior.
Yeah.
But, you know, we could take weight loss, for example. Say someone's 20, 30 kilos overweight. If someone has very little time, they're a mum, father, and working, you know, 50, 60 hours. If that person once says, I want to lose weight, but then is not willing to devote any time to that process, they're already out of the game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. If you say, look, I'm busy, I've got kids and I work, then you're already out because you're not willing to make the time for it.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to say, okay, I do these things, but how can I make a little bit of time?
Mm-hmm.
How much time do I actually have on a practical level each week to put into my weight loss?
Yeah.
To get to the gym or to go on a walk or to go and buy the healthy food or to even log on and, you know, log on to the where you get your groceries from and get them to deliver it, you know, but making the time. So if you don't make the time, you won't have the time.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, making the time can prolong the time you're here as well, you know, as much as we don't have a gauge.
Absolutely.
Making the time can prolong that.
And maybe it's that metric. It's hard to there are things that are hard to gauge, and this is off point, but it might make the point. For example, like with how we are with COVID at the moment, the true cost of everything that's going on is unseen.
Yeah.
100%.
People are looking at the things that we can see and saying this is the cost and this is why we're doing this, but they're not seeing the unseen, which is where the real hard to quantify cost is.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the same thing.
Yeah.
The cost of not exercising or making the time is being in hospitals, having, you know, all these awful treatments that you need to go through. That's the real cost.
Yeah.
Energy, there are people that are, you know, tired and fatigued, and I imagine someone's like a little battery in the morning and you've got so much energy and that's what you have to divide up all of your tasks.
Yeah.
So how much energy do you realistically have to put into your weightless program?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, if you're tired already and your sleep's awful and you can't get out of bed, then you need to find a way to think about how much practical energy you actually have and what you can divert from other unnecessary or, you know, less priority tasks to give you the energy for what you need to do in order to make that behavior change.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. I skip resources. I can't spell.
About to say, your spelling's just gone worse. It's become tour.
I love that. Very good.
True. Resources.
Let's talk about resources. So, same thing. That can be financial,
mm-hmm.
whether you have money to buy a gym membership or to have a personal trainer or a coach or money to buy organic food.
Yeah.
But
it's not just money. Resources could be like support, right?
Right.
As well, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, like having someone cook you nice food or
exactly.
something like that.
Do you have a training buddy? Do you have someone that you can hold you accountable?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Is your gym like an hour from your house? And do you need to travel an hour each way to get to your gym? You're already putting yourself in a bad position.
Yeah.
If you need to travel 2 hours to get the exercise, it's unfeasible.
Yeah.
So, you know, trying to cut back some of the obstacles as far as resources.
Mm-hmm.
E, we talked about. And then W, willingness. Why do you – this is the biggest one as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. Why do you want to change?
Yeah.
Why me, why this, and why now? If you've been overweight your whole life or whatever it is, why? and how willing are you to do it? If something means a terrible amount to you, you'll make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
But you need to understand the why.
Mm-hmm.
If it's you have a wedding coming up and you want to look in shape, or you're someone in your family died from some horrible disease or complication of whatever, knowing that, reflecting on that, and making that your greatest ally. I'm doing this behavior because of this, and this is what it means to me. Because you can connect with that over and over again, and you're unlikely to give up on that if you know that. It allows you to embrace the support and challenge, the hard times, and be like, we talked about discipline last time, and how hard it is to lose weight or be in the gym or to look, you know, to look after yourself. It's hard. But if you have that why in the forefront of your mind, and you're not obsessive about it, but you know, and you're constantly reminding yourself. That's what willingness is.
I think that's super important. You know, I had a bit of a thing this week where, you know, I was like, it's sometimes I'd be doing so many different things, you know, buying businesses, developing properties, selling properties, educating people, And I think one of the things I really realized this week was the simplest thing, which was why I'm doing it. And it is because I get so much pleasure out of helping people. Do you know what I mean? I just get so much pleasure, whether it's the simplest thing, whether it's a buddy going, hey, Mitch, do you know a chippy that can help me? Yeah, no, no problem. Or else someone going, hey, fuck it, I got this shit going on with my, you know, my boss, and I just can't get my head around it. Or I got this great idea of this business, Mitch, and I just don't know how to get it off the ground. I just love being able to sit with someone going, well, hey, have you looked at it this way? Mm-hmm. Hey, you know, that's, I just love that. That exchange of somebody helped me,
right?
So I want to help you. Do you know what I mean? And I realized what it did for them when they helped me, and what it did for me, and what it does for me when I help them, and what it does for them.
Which ultimately it comes down to love underlying it all. And I think most people's why or willingness or dream is about love and connection.
Yeah.
And if for you, Mitch, if you're able to help somebody and look them in the eye, and they can say, "You have helped me."
Yeah,
that connection and that love that you get out of that—that's your—that's what's driving you.
Yeah,
just like what's driving me, I want to empower people to look after to get the best out of their life, to transform.
Yeah. Yeah,
and if I can sit with someone and they can look at me in the eye, and you know, there's an altruism and a narcissism within it. There's a part of me that gets a reward or a growth through helping them. So there's a sort of self element, but then there's also the bit for them. And it's those fusion of those in perfect balance.
Yeah.
Helping yourself and helping them.
Yeah.
Well, that's it, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I think there's, you know, there's something that happens between you and a person when you're in that state. If you can get the ego out of the way and, you know, I helped you. There's something that happens in that moment that's very lovely, that's very humbling, that has no identity. It's not you and me. It's not me and helping you. It's we both got something here. And wasn't it magical that we got to experience it together? Do you know what I mean? Even if it is literally just referring a trade onto someone else, it's fucking bonkers. But for me, you know, if I can walk away going, God, you know, I know that he's going to get great help there, and I know that he's going to feel appreciative And I know that, and I feel appreciative that because someone did that for me, you know.
Do you think that's born out of your suffering, or generally, do you think when you know that you've suffered and you don't want somebody else to, and you see that you're able to remedy that, is it through your greatest struggles, Mitch, that you, your greatest dreams are born? And
yeah, I think it is true. I think it's true a desire to connect. Does that make sense? Like I just, as a kid, I was very disconnected from my brothers, you know.
By the way, Mitch, I'm interviewing you.
Yeah, thank you, sir. Okay. But I was very disconnected from my brothers, like really disconnected from my brothers. And I just was a little kid going, well, why do you guys, what's the problem? You know, you know, and there were moments that I had with them that were way more weighty and meant much more to me than the moments that I wasn't. And so I always wanted to try to recreate those moments where I would just bond with them and connect with them, you know what I mean? And I just found that over time, being able to do that for other people, you could, once you veer from your family, you know, it's at that whole age thing, you know, 7 to 14, you start to veer from your family and you start to have those experiences with your buddies. You know, in those moments, they were timeless, you know, they were spaceless, they were chargeless, they were massless, they were just moments of just connection with someone, where we both just got to experience something that was magical. You know, it's like when we're studying for something, you know, and we're creating something, and you have that moment where you're just in that flow state, and we're both realize we're coming together, we're organizing something, and we can see it, and there's a magic moment, and it's like, you know, oh my God, can you feel it? And the people are going to love this. You know, when we show it this way, they're going to love it. And that stems out of, as a kid, feeling or perceiving that I wasn't connected. Does that make sense? But when I stop and look at it, I got the connection from my dad that my brothers didn't get. Does that make sense? So they didn't connect with me, but they gave me my dad, and I have a great connection with my father, you know?
But the answer to that is yes, in a way, because then in his perception of suffering, or you asked about the suffering, was the fact that he didn't feel connected, so he... there's a drive to go and feel connected.
Yeah, and I think it's important for people to understand that suffering is not... suffering is not seeing. Do you know what I mean? That's what suffering is. It's not, you know, I've hurt myself.
The experience. It's the fact that you didn't see the truth in that experience. You didn't see what was really happening in that moment.
Perception of an absence of love and then later a restoration of love.
And that's the same for me. It's like when you feel like something isn't there, you want to go and give that. Like, that's everybody, right?
Yeah.
So we were just discussing it the other day, that how valuable it is for us to feel like people, like, get value out of what we do, you know, and just in terms of the money stuff, like just something simple, because money is really easy to master, right? Just in terms of something like that. And people coming back and saying thank you, and how much of a difference. People you don't see for years, you haven't seen for 10 years, and they just say to you, I wouldn't have been able to get through this without what you taught me 10 years ago. That's phenomenal for us, you know?
Yeah.
So, I think that where did we have that conversation? Where did that conversation start from, though? I don't know. But I think that definitely it's born of the fact that we feel like that's missing, so we go and chase that in our lives, you know. The only place, though, that you can find that is within yourself. And so that whole true thing that you're talking about, that true change, is finding, knowing that desire, the willingness is there. That's where it came from. That's why we were talking about it, right? The willingness is there. Our why is there. And then if the why is there, you will find the time, you will find the resources, you will find the energy, because the willingness is there. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely.
100%. So we said we would touch on a little bit of the plant medicine. Do you want to talk a little bit about that and how that relates to your journey and what you've done and what you think it does for people?
Sure. I mostly bring it up one of our previous conversations. Mitch sort of brought it up, and we talked about the idea of psychedelics or hallucinogenic plant medicines being coming into a new frontier. And I think most people have a bit of an idea about the history of plant medicines and how they were sort of used in native tribes and shamanic healing ceremonies.
Yeah.
And, you know, all over the world. And then sort of fell into the, they were sort of within the hands of tribal communities and villages, and then fell into the hands of the West, which gained a lot of exposure and ultimately ended up with the condemnation of, you know, the war against drugs, particularly in the US. And there was a lot of research going on prior to that into things like psilocybin, magic mushrooms, LSD, among other things. A lot of research that was shelved when these things became sort of class A drugs or drugs of abuse. What's happening at the moment now, and I think a lot of people are talking about this, is there's a resurgence of research into plant medicines. Not just talking about, you know, somebody in their own time taking trips and, you know, getting bent out of shape and, you know, partying or, you know, using these in other ways. But the healing that is possible with these medications, these medicines.
And, so, and getting documented heavily now.
So John Hopkins University is one particular institution that's doing lots of the research. I mean, it's becoming popular in the media as well. You're hearing a lot about it. People are talking about these plant medicines and psychedelics. Some of the interesting research that I've been looking through recently is the use of, for example, psilocybin, magic mushrooms, in quitting smoking and alcohol addiction, and also in the people that have been diagnosed with sort of terminal illnesses and making that transition, not necessarily into death, but coming to terms with a terminal diagnosis and making that transition much more healing rather than based in fear. So some of the interesting statistics, and we're talking about controlled studies of these substances with researchers and counsellors and, you know, people that are experienced in overseeing that process. But something I found amazing was they've done studies with smokers. They've taken people that have been smoking for 30, 40 years, people that have tried many different ways to quit, and then have given them controlled experience with psilocybin, sort of a mushroom trip, or up to three trips, one at the time, one at sort of 2 weeks, and then one at, say, 8 weeks. And they've had sort of, their intention is to quit smoking. That's the framework and the intention within the study. And seeing people, you know, 8 out of 10 people at 6 months have quit. Long-term, lifelong smokers doing, you know, damage to their system through cigarettes. Whereas if you compare that to, say, Champix, which you guys might be familiar with, is one of the nicotine, helps people stop smoking, basically, one of the medications commonly used by the doctors, is probably about 30% at 6 months. And that's what we're giving out to people, or we have been until recently. And now there's this modality that can get somebody to have multiple experiences where it's a profound shift in their way of looking at the world and the habit itself, and to have an 80% sort of cessation rate of smoking at 6 months is
bonkers.
Well, it speaks for itself, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's good. That's crazy. So, are you aware of how they're doing this? Is it through a shaman? Is it through a GP? Is it, how are they doing it?
It's, I don't know the exact setting. It's done in some kind of clinic-based setting where the participants will come in and will be in a very safe environment with low stimulation. They might have eye masks on and headphones, but they're a sort of experienced, maybe they're shamans, maybe they're counsellors, people that are well-versed in caring for people when they're sort of under these profound experiences. And sort of nursing them through any psychological duress or anything that might come up.
And they're back looking at MDMA now very, very closely as well.
Are they?
Yeah, I didn't
know that.
For dealing with PTSD and depression.
Because they used to do that, didn't they?
Well, they use it really for marital purposes if you were having a breakdown in your marriage.
I thought they used to use it for PTSD and stuff, didn't they?
No, maybe it's just now.
I can't speak to MDMA too much. I know that it's getting a lot of attention. That'll be the next thing that I put some of my attention into to get a bit of an idea of what they're doing there. The other one is, you know, chronic alcoholics,
mm-hmm.
finding that they can take somebody and give them experience with either LSD or a magic mushroom, and in a controlled setting, that person can quit alcohol.
Really?
Did you watch that The Last Shaman on Netflix?
I haven't seen that.
It's fantastic.
Okay.
Really, 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 really good. It's basically about a young guy in the US who's suffering from depression. His father takes him everywhere, and they end up in some of the top universities in the US, leading and speaking with the top psychologists, who literally come to them and go, look, when it comes to physical trauma, we're all over it. But when it comes to the mind, we have absolutely no idea what we're doing. We don't know what we're doing. We're poking around in a bush and we're not getting anywhere. And they suggested to him that he goes and tries ayahuasca.
Mm.
And then it's about the journey of going and trying ayahuasca. And it's really traumatic documentary to watch, but it was just fantastic, you know?
And what could be more transformational or confronting than someone who's given a terminal diagnosis? They're told that you will die from this.
Yeah.
And notoriously in the West, we don't have a very good concept around death and dying. We try and shove things under the rug.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Some of the other, you know, Eastern philosophy and other Eastern cultures have a much different way of looking at that, as far as a transformation rather than a definite end point.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
To approach going into the ground or above or wherever, you know, finishing your life in fear is it's a traumatic idea to get your head around altogether.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's why that's prompted some research into managing with LSD or psilocybin and getting people to come to terms through a very profound personal healing journey and understanding the greater context of their life and what that diagnosis means.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how transformational must that be to bring someone to a point where they're at ease with the fact that they are dying and that's a part of life as well.
Yeah. It's one of those things, isn't it? We're so attached to the physical. We all are. I mean, I'm speaking for myself. I'm so attached to my physical well-being and my physical body, and I limit my mind to my lifetime. You know, I wonder what would happen if we really, really got that we were immortal, you know?
Mm.
How unlimited would our minds actually be?
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? Because if you look at how we treat ourselves and the world and the planet, we have this short amount of time. You know, there's only a very few amount of people have an immortal view of why they're here.
Right.
In this time period. Do you know what I mean? And I mean, there's always lots of talk about it. There's always lots of talk around it. We all want to understand our immortality as opposed to defending our mortality, you know?
Right.
But I think we defend our mortality at the cost of our immortal view of what we actually are.
Well, I think we defend it because we forget that we are immortal. We forget. We think that we are only one part, just like we were speaking about previously. I think in the previous podcast, thinking that we're just physical. Mm. We're not just physical. We're mental. We're spiritual. We are all of that.
Mm.
So we defend the mortality because we forget that we are not that. This is not all of who we are.
Yeah.
I think some of the people I've listened to who are talking about what's going on now in this time, in this day and age, with all the fear that's being that's being shown, you know, fear of COVID, fear of the vaccine, fear of this, fear of that. Everybody's in fear. Like, well, not everybody's in fear, but there's a lot of fear being like it's out there. But the only fear is a fear of losing the mortal self. When you stop feeling the fear of losing the mortal self and realizing you're not just that, regardless of which angle you're coming from, that's when, for me, that's when you're empowered, because then you know that you are not that. You are not just this. I am all, you know what I mean?
Like,
when you're in fear, somebody can tell you what to do. Somebody can make you do something, whichever side of the fence you sit on. Somebody can make you do something so that you can alleviate that fear, you know, that you will either do something or will not do something because of that fear. But when you get that you are not just this thing, you're not this flesh, like, you know, there's something different happens. You are not you're not pushed and pulled. It's like you stop subordinating to that level of mm-hmm. fear and that level, and you realize that you are greater than that, and that fear doesn't
yeah.
play a part in mm-hmm. who you
are. And that I think that's part of the journey of life, is that expanding awareness.
Yeah.
The holding hand in hand with fear is courage.
Yes.
So mm-hmm. when somebody brings in a fearful experience or there's things that are happening, mm-hmm. the gift within that is that it's asking you, are you willing?
Yes.
And can you walk in your courage? Can you stand in your power? Can you overcome this, mm-hmm. whatever that looks like?
Yeah.
And that's the journey. You know, if I look at who I was 5 years ago, I didn't have these ideas. Mm-hmm. And it's been through a journey of exploration that you start to unpack and you start to find your courage.
Yes.
And
yes.
you say, it's the hero's journey, isn't it?
Yeah.
You're walking along and you're expanding, hopefully expanding your sense of awareness and growing and evolving your ideas around what we are mm. and where we're going and what our purpose is.
Yeah, and I think that's important how you've said it, the expansion, because when you're expanding, you are not at the mercy of the fear. So when you're expanding, you're overseeing it. You see that it's not that, you know, and so therefore you can walk through, because I've picked up, I know we've said it a million times, but you said just a moment ago about being at ease. That at ease is the place that we're looking for. That at ease is that midpoint. When you're outside of that, that's that midpoint, that love point, you know, because when you're outside of that, you're in fear. You're being pushed or you're being pulled, you know. You're in on one extreme or another extreme. When you are at ease, like you were talking about in the previous podcast about the nervous systems being balanced out, you know. When you're in balance like that and you're at ease with that, that isn't controlling you. You are in control of it. And so I think, and that's where disease doesn't come from. Like when you're at ease, you're not making those decisions. You're not making these decisions for your life being pushed or pulled by something else. You're not making a decision based on fear. You're making a decision being based on an expanded awareness, completely at ease with no matter what happens, you're going to be okay. Mm-hmm. And then from that point, disease doesn't have that, can't take that hold because of the fact that you're in balance with it. You're not out of balance.
I guess you guys would call that your equilibration point, correct, isn't it? Or yeah. your equanimous center.
Yes.
I once had what I call a union experience. I was down in Fremantle where I was living, and I'd recently at that time crashed my motorcycle and I'd sort of had a near-death experience. And then sort of a few months down the track, and I was at the house I was living in Fremantle when so on my bed meditating, and there was a lot of thoughts in my head around mortality and that near death. And, you know, I meditated a lot and never had an experience like this, but I went somewhere. I was awake and I was open-eyed, but I was a circle, complete union that I've never felt ever again mm-hmm. in my life. And I was white light and I had tears just running down my face, but not tears of unhappiness.
Mm-hmm.
But the ease that I felt, I can't mm-hmm. put into words.
Mm-hmm.
It was perfect
mm-hmm.
yeah.
for a moment,
yes.
for 10 minutes, and I was trying to write it down what it felt like and take photos, and yeah. I was trying to record
the
it.
The old brain kicks back in again.
Right, the analytical.
Yeah. Document this quickly.
Right, point Dexter. But
yeah.
that union experience was something I'll never forget.
Yeah.
yeah.
And feeling whole for the very first time in my life was yeah. was non-drug experience, very profound.
Mm.
That's cool.
Funny how life does that, you know, teases you with these moments. Mm. You know,
get me back there. Yeah. That was really awesome. Thanks for sharing your story today. Yeah. Thanks for sharing about those steps for making true change. I think that's something that people can really take away and implement. And I think that willingness is a key point in that.
Time, and resources, energy and willingness, it's great.
Mm-hmm.
Just something to reflect on before you go and buy the new ASICs and the new like gym equipment.
Yeah.
Map out a bit of a plan and just be like, what are my obstacles that I'm yeah. going to face yeah. and how can I solve them in advance?
Yeah.
Because it's going to be hard.
Yeah.
But it's having that yeah. framework before you begin.
Yeah. 100%.
And just want to say thank you. It's nice to be able to share that story. There's emotion in that for me, and but it's important to get that out there as well.
Yeah,
well, sure. I think it's important for people to see that, you know, it doesn't matter who you are. You've got, like, it's wise to be aware of the fact that there's, that you know, you had emotional things that were impacting what was going on, you know. You had your self-worth stuff. You had all of that stuff that was making you feel like not enough in this place. Mm-hmm. And it takes that crisis sometimes for you to go back in, look at yourself, put these new practices in place. And if I was to ask you if you could ever go back and change that, would you ever go back and change that crisis that you had?
Of course.
Because that is what creates the person that you are today. And the level of gratitude that we can have to those experiences in our lives, no matter what has happened to us, is key to us being in that place of ease. And that's why we do what we do. You know, we will literally be speaking to people because we can see, like, this is not something we have to do.
Mm.
This is something we love to do. Mm. And then also we're kind of obligated to do because somebody did it for us. And because somebody did it for us and said, look, like, somebody did it for me, you did it for me. Mills, you are loved.
Mm-hmm.
I never, ever, ever, ever felt that. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I felt that, it was like I'm obligated to show other people this same thing. I have the skill to be able to show people that.
Yes.
And for people to get that, that is something that I don't take lightly, I don't take for granted. And it's very important to be able to recognise that, you know, these things happen in our lives for a reason. I would not go back and change one little thing, because if I did, I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be able to do what I'm doing.
And the thing is that I know there's people out there sometimes hear that and think, yeah, but it wasn't as bad as what happened to me.
Yeah.
Mm. You know, and you think, no, it's not bias, you know.
No.
It's the same for everybody.
It's relative to the person.
Yeah.
It's what is happening for you is.
And it just means that if you really see it that way, and holding on to that concept rips you off of such humility and magic, and, you know, understanding that the universe has actually, you know, you are meant to be here, and mm-hmm. there are things that you're here to do with what happened, you know.
So ultimately it's about you as the listener. It's about you and others. But start with you.
Yeah.
It has to start
with you. With you, and it will emanate into others.
100%. Mm. Thanks so much, Dave. Can't wait to have you on again.
You!
Thank you so much.
Hey, whether this is you at the beginning of your personal development journey, or you're perhaps immersed in your growth and transformation, at MJB Seminars, we have everything to help you live an inspired life.
If this episode resonated and you're looking for more information on how to have an actual breakthrough and transform your life, visit us over at mjbseminars.com.au and book yourself in for a complimentary discovery coaching call.
Also, make sure you like and follow us over on Instagram and Facebook, and review and subscribe to Dorothy and the Dealer today.